Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s. And each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Do you know? It's Friday. It's time to do radio. Time for us to hang out. Time for us to welcome Michael Harrison back for his weekly visit. Hello there, sir.
Hello, Todd, and I hope that you are well.
I am just always well, I think, at 3 o'clock.
You sound so Friday exuberant.
I'm every day exuberant when I'm on the radio. It's just something energizing. It's like this adrenaline shove right into your veins.
You know, it's really amazing.
You get that way?
Yes, but the difference between you on the air and not that you're not real on the air, but the difference between your energy level on the air and your energy level off the air is profound. Whereas I'm about the same.
Well,
all
you're
the time.
You're not paying me to perform when we're when we're talking on the phone. I'm just talking.
No, but you're very, but folks, people don't realize. Let me tell you, I know this guy a long time. He's one of the coolest guys, you know. Hi, Michael. It's Todd. How you doing, Todd? I'm doing fine. What's going on?
Yeah, I'm flat.
Are you mad at me, Todd?
Are
you mad at me, Todd? No, I'm not mad. Why would you think that? I'm not making fun of you.
It's taken me a long time to realize. No, it's totally true about me, and I tell people that, and they try to deny it, and I just know they're afraid to tell me the truth.
Well, what happens to you when you go on the air that this inner personality like emerges? What do? You put it away.
You know what it is?
What is it? Tell me. I wanted to know this. All the years I know you.
One part is what you can get away with on the air that people laugh and say, oh, he's a great guy. Isn't he funny? They would hate you in person. It's a different expectation on the radio. Part one. Part two is, wait, what is part two? Is there a part two?
Well, maybe part one has an A and a B.
No, part two is this is a performance medium. And the nature of performing is you find the pieces of yourself that work best in the situation. And you grow those, and the parts that don't, you obliterate. And that's where I am. So I got rid of the flat me for being on the air, because who wants to listen to that?
Well, I don't know how flat it is. You're very intelligent and you're very credible. It's just that your level of animation.
Yeah, flat. The energy goes way down.
Yeah, flat has a negative connotation. I would say it's calm.
Well, I think it's negative because everyone complains about me on the phone. Wow, is this you? What's wrong?
When you say
you're
on the
like
phone,
the guy on the radio.
You mean when you talk to people in one-on-one conversations? I'm not the only one who's noticed this. How does Rosalie deal with it?
Well, I think she likes that better.
Likes what better? The flat you or the inflated you?
Yeah, the flat me. The flat me. Do you do anything different when you're on the air? Do you alter yourself? Do you find that you extract a certain aspect of yourself that people enjoy on the radio?
On the radio, I try not to use foul language, which I may use off the air. I'm basically the same person. Well, you know me for a long time. Am I the same person when you and I have...
I think you're pretty similar.
Yeah. I was once... I was once having dinner with Todd. We were with our wives back when people used to have dinner together. Folks, this is about 2 years ago. And Todd and I see each other in person maybe once every 3 years. We're not talking, we don't hang out together. We talk on the phone, and this bit that we've done now for 3 or 4 years together on Fridays has certainly given us a connection and a link and a bond. But we're sitting in this restaurant. We hadn't seen each other in about a year, maybe 8 months. And he looks at me and he says, "Forgive me for staring, but it's very hard for me to deal with the fact that that voice is coming out of that face."
Did I really?
Yeah.
That's funny.
Because you're used to me just being a disembodied voice. And then, you know, it's coming out of a person. And you found it to be enough. But you were just like staring at me. And I asked, "What's going on?" He said, "Forgive me."
Well, isn't that a funny thing about radio? Everybody meets you and they say, "Oh, you don't look like what I expected." Well, you've never seen me. How would you know what to expect? But people think because... There's something about the sound of your voice that creates an image in people's minds, even though they have no reason to think that would be accurate.
Well, before there were many platforms, before there was multi-platform broadcasting and radio was an isolated medium like television was and newspapers, everything with their own track, there was basically the feeling that radio being the theater of the mind, many DJs and radio personalities were better off if nobody saw them. Like they put their picture up on a billboard and you go, "That's the guy that I've been listening to. That's him. That schlep," you know. So now with, you know, TV and video and everything, people know what radio people look like. They're on the website. The pictures are everywhere. And I think to a certain degree, not completely, because you can't make a broad generalization, but to a certain degree, a bit of the mystery and intrigue of audio broadcasting, of radio, is lost when people know what you look like.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true or not, but certainly in the theater, they have that thing where somebody on stage isn't supposed to come out after the performance and be seen. You don't want to break that illusion, right?
Right, especially if they still have the makeup on and, you know, and then you go, "Oh, wow, it wasn't real." And then there are actors that actually leave the wig on all day or leave the costume on even when they're not on because they don't want to break character because it's so hard to do that. But there's just, you know, radio is funny. It has so much to the imagination. And I know when I do occasionally appear on television and you know, you ask your friends how to go, 90% of the time, and I'm just trying to say, most of the time, they'll say, "It was great. Would you like a? You look good. You look good."
Wait, you must have the wrong channel on.
But I mean, they judge it completely on what you look like. "Well, did you hear what I said?" "Not really. But you look great." You know? Well, you don't have that on radio to look good or to, you know, "Why'd you pick that tie? You know, that tie didn't go with that shirt." All of that stuff. It's so different. So when you get a guy like Sean Hannity, he's a double threat. A guy like Sean Hannity does something that's very difficult. He made it in two absolutely different forms of media. Go ahead. What were you going to say? I'm sorry.
I forget. That's really interesting, though, about Sean. Because, he is a hard worker and he's very attentive. So he's the kind of guy. But didn't he come up in radio and then went over into TV?
Right? He is still, I'll tell you, whether you like his politics or not, whatever, wonderful guy, loves radio. As somebody that observes and works with the industry on an industrial level, this guy never turned his back on radio as his fortunes in television grew. And to this day, he defends radio. He loves radio. He stays with radio. And he is what we call in the business, folks, a radio guy, meaning that there are people in the radio business that it's just in their blood. I guess every field has people like that, the people that just love that field more than it just
you're talking about where your
end.
Heart is.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess in
a
way,
Sean
I'm
is
that way.
Well, me too. I just love this medium. And I, you know, you can't really define why that happens. It just happens to you. I remember my parents used to have a tape of me from when my father brought home a tape recorder from work, I think, and recorded himself talking to me when I was 2 years old. And me being fascinated and him explaining to me in a technical way how a microphone worked and me going, yes, Dada. And there was nothing he was saying that I could have comprehended, but I loved it even then. And I was fascinated with telephones and liked to build telephones out of scrap pieces when I was a kid. Communications has always intrigued me, and I was always attracted to radio. And it's just one of those things. You have these built-in predilections, I guess.
Right. Now, conversely, to bring the folks that are listening to this conversation into it, there are people that like listening to radio and enjoy it more than other media, that they actually enjoy audio-only media more than television or movies or reading.
And, can I tell you something about that? My grandkids, everyone makes videos of them all the time. Nobody makes audio. I have a little audio recorder on my phone. We're sitting talking. I will just turn on the audio recorder. And everybody responds in a bigger way to the audio-only. Like, there's something revelatory about it. And you would think it's the opposite, but there's something about hearing the voice alone where you are really being drawn into the person in a different way.
Yes, and you don't have the distraction of the screen. It makes the audio be full dimensional as opposed to, you know, being part of
an
what
adjunct.
You're asking, right, well, you're asking your senses to do. I suspect we have a break coming up, so I'm not going to start a story. But
okay, you can tease the story.
Yeah,
Michael has a story.
Yeah, the frustration. I'm going to write it down so I don't forget, because sometimes my mind sparks in different directions and I forget it after the break. How difficult it is to get people in radio to listen to radio, to listen to audio. We'll talk about that afterwards.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
It's Friday. Michael Harrison is here on WTIC. Okay. It's Friday. Michael's here, and he's got a story he wants to tell us. He is a master storyteller, by the way, has won multiple awards, and just will hold your attention like nobody you've ever heard. Go ahead, Michael.
Right.
No
pressure. Once upon a time, I don't have a story. I was just telling basically an insight that over the years, I've had the opportunity to put on conventions for radio people and people that are in the radio business. And one of the things that I find interesting is that if you make an audio presentation to people who are in the audio business, it's very hard. And this is almost true for everybody, but especially for people in radio, you can't get them to listen. They start talking. They start talking amongst themselves. If you have something on a screen, they're not as apt to talk. That's why a lot of people have PowerPoints that absolutely say absolutely nothing. You know, it's like 25%.
That's the point. That's why those boring things are the most used public speaking tool in the world, because they get people to shut up.
Yeah. Yeah. People stare at a big pie that says something that's inane. 25%. And then you see the green part of a round circle, 25 graphs, bars, all that stuff. Because have you ever had the experience of saying to somebody, I want you to listen to this show or this tape or an audio presentation?
Oh, yeah.
Other than in the car, there's something psychological about the motion of a car facing forward with the road coming at you and the speaker coming from the dashboard that captures your attention.
So it's not about being alone, that if I were alone in the room and you said, listen to this, I wouldn't react differently than if I was with 300 people?
I just think that you would eventually start talking to me, or you don't know what to do with your eyes. Have you ever played a record for somebody or played something and you're both sitting there and you're staring at them to see their reaction? And, and they get a little bit uncomfortable? The whole psychology of presenting audio in person, as opposed to a person going through the business of listening to the radio. But it just is funny. And I've always.
But maybe it's because of the power of radio that it's a personal thing. Mm-hmm. And so you're asking somebody to do something that feels intimate in what you do alone, where, you might have an activity you like to do. Like I walk around usually when I'm listening to something or, you know, have another activity that I'm doing. And maybe it's just weird to have another person watching you when you're listening.
Well, back when I was a music radio programmer, the record company guys, the reps, would come to the station and they'd want to play a record for you. You're going to hear this brand new Elton John song, you know, and you sit there and they put it on. You put it on the turntable in those days and then eventually CDs. And, you know, for the next 3.5 minutes, I've got to sit here with this guy listening to this song. Mm-hmm. You don't know what to do with your face. Yeah, because the guy who's playing it for you is looking at you to see your reaction. And therefore, have you ever been in that situation? So you bob your head a little bit. You look seriously intent, but you don't want to seem too excited because then they'd expect you to play the record on the radio. So these are all silly little things that kind of reflect the way our brains are wired.
I think people enjoy that kind of story because who even knows? Who even thinks about it? How does that record get to be on this radio station and why do I hear it? I know people get mad about having to hear certain songs and why do they play this so much and why don't they play that song? They never play that song. But there is a whole process and there is a whole industry of people pitching music to programmers. At least there used to be. I don't know how it works.
More so in the old days. More so in the old days. Today it's very corporate, very centralized, and there's not as much wheeler dealering, Wild West, regionalism.
And it's not as personal, right? There used to be DJs who were celebrities because of the way they put music together and talked about it or whatever. Right. And I remember when I was running my college radio station, there was a rep from big record companies who just came to the college radio stations to make sure you knew about the new albums. And there was this whole system of making everybody aware and making them feel that certain things were cool. And it really worked, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a whole different culture. As a matter of fact, I worked at a publication called Radio and Records prior to being at Billboard and then having my own publications. But Radio and Records was an industry. And today there really isn't a radio. And first of all, there's no records. It's music. But there's no radio and record industry. Their interests have kind of veered off in separate directions. And
do people buy physical music anymore? Or are they just buying rights to something on Pandora or Spotify or something?
That is a loaded question full of intrigue. The internet, it started with Napster. You may remember Napster.
Oh, I love Napster.
Yeah, it started with Napster. The record industry didn't play their cards right. And because of the internet, the intellectual property rights of musicians and record companies has gone up for grabs. And countless millions of dollars are lost to fans of music that think it's like getting ketchup at a restaurant. It's a condiment. That you would never pay for the ketchup, you'd never pay for the salt, you just pay for the hamburger. Well, they consider music to be ketchup and salt. It just comes with it. You know, you can go to YouTube and get almost any record ever made. I remember when Elvis Presley died, there were radio stations that called themselves rock, but, you know, they were very, you know, oriented to one kind or another. But when Elvis died, it was like this big deal, and the radio stations couldn't find an Elvis record in their libraries because they didn't have them because they weren't playing them. And they had to rush out to stores in the city, wherever they were, to try to buy an Elvis record to get it on for their newscasts. Because if you didn't have a record, you could not get your hands on that music. Now you can get any kind of music you want in a second. Think about that difference.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. You couldn't.
That's one of those big changes that you forgot about. It's kind of like the idea of having to know how to get places in the car. We used to have to know. We used to have a storage device in our brains that would remember how streets were laid out and see the relationships between sections of a city in our own heads. And now we just expect the phone to do it for us.
Having to read a map while you're driving.
My father had these books in the glove compartment.
Yeah, yeah. Or you go on a vacation.
What were they called?
A AAA triptych.
And oh, atlases. They were. Is that what they were, atlases?
The triptych. They would take a magic marker, yellow, and they'd
fall. Oh, I'm sorry, Michael. We have to go.
Okay,
we have to go. It's break time. We will talk more with Michael Harrison coming up on WTIC. Oh, Michael Harrison is here. You know that's the Friday thing. What do you think, Michael? The country is on COVID fire again. Did you anticipate this?
Of course I did. We talked about it. It's a shame.
I don't listen when people are making me listen to audio, though.
I'll send you a photo of myself so you can look at it while yes, we do this.
That will help.
No, I'm frustrated. I'm angry. I'm sad. I'm worried. And this is a very, very dark period that we're living in. And we're surrounded by BS artists, if you pardon the expression, on all fronts. And that includes the President of the United
Wait,
States.
On all fronts?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you mean politically?
I'm talking about in terms of authority. I mean, I believe yeah. people like Dr. Fauci mean well. But I think that people have got to grow up and realize that this is a real problem and that you can't look for empirical guidance from any authority on whether or not it's safe for you to go about living your life the way you'd like to. And this is a key thing. I mean, I believe a lot of Americans don't think this thing is real. And I don't mean that they think it's a conspiracy or a fake, although I hear that too. And let me tell you, the people that are the governors and the mayors of all these cities and places, and even the president, are not smart enough to pull off a conspiracy using a disease like this to take control of our lives. They're just trying different methods and different things, some with different levels of effectiveness, to try to keep this thing together. And this whole argument between the masks or we've got to get back to business, it reminds me of the mayor in Jaws. And I haven't seen the movie in years, but I remember the mayor was totally, absolutely obsessed with the idea that the presence of that white shark, that great white shark that came along, that the size and ferocity of which we had never seen before in this quaint New England town. And he said, go into the water, come on. You know, the idea of closing the beach on a big holiday weekend was the worst thing that can happen because it would destroy the economy of his little town. And he was encouraging everybody to go in the water. And of course, somebody got chomped. That's what this appears to me to be like. It's like, okay, we've quarantined. Okay, we've done what we had to. We want to go out now and we want to go back to our lives, and it's coming to us because we're a bunch of entitled fat slobs. And that's troubling to me.
But isn't that an honest debate that has to be ongoing? Because
yes.
you do have the tension between those two things. You can't just sit forever waiting for the virus to go away.
Well, what if it were that dangerous that you had to?
Well, that would be a unique situation that this is not.
And you don't consider this situation unique?
Well, not that unique. I consider this a little bit unique in that it's a worse virus than what we're accustomed to. It's, you know, it's five times a bad flu season or whatever factor it is. But what we do, what makes this one a gift as an enemy is that it's very particular in what it's interested in. And if you took the mishandling of Manhattan out of this, the New York deaths and the nursing home deaths out of this, and corrected for a couple of things that were screwed up because they were trying to do across-the-board protection instead of targeted protection to the vulnerable groups, I think they've made it a lot worse by not just sitting down and saying, okay, this is obviously going to kill people over 70 at way higher rates than everybody else. And we need to take all the expertise and all the focus to older people, vulnerable populations, and say, how do we advise these people to best protect themselves? Because I think if we had told seniors, you need to socially isolate because you're vulnerable, and if we had protected nursing homes like the hot spot potentials that they were, and taken seriously the idea that thousands of people could die there sitting ducks, which they have, then we would have had a much better outcome. Young people would have gone and exposed themselves, and we would have had a much higher exposure rate. I mean, they said today it's 10 times what they've told us, but I wish it were 30 or 40 times, so we'd be further along towards the herd immunity that we're looking for.
We have no guarantee that herd immunity even plays a role in this.
Well, we don't, but we need it to, because we can't sit forever. So you ask the question, what do we do if it's way worse than this? We still have to figure out who's safe and send those people out to get food, right?
There's no question. And I certainly don't mean to present chaos or doomsday. But when you say we can't sit this out forever, where do you get that information? How do you know that we're not going to be stuck like this for the rest of our lives? And
well, we could be stuck like this, but we would be going to work. We would keep our economy moving. We wouldn't shut things down and tell everybody to go hide for 3 months.
Okay. I understand what you're saying. I look at it differently. I look at it that there are things that can happen within our world that are so devastating and so unexpected and so challenging to the frailty and fragility of our existence that we cannot just assume that our system is forever and that our economy is forever and that our way of life is forever. Stuff happens. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that this is stuff that's going to happen, but I have no proof that it's not. Until there's a vaccine, until these numbers go down everywhere, until we don't get inconsistent information about whether young people get it, old people get it, children get it, all of this stuff, I'm not ready to marginalize seniors, say, well, it's only old people, so the rest of their lives, old people should be kept away from their parents, from their children, rather, their grandchildren. Think about what you're saying.
Well, we do that either way, though. That's all I'm saying. What I'm saying is seniors have been locked down. Seniors have been the ones who are cautious. Seniors have said the kids can't come over with the grandkids.
Right.
That's just what we have to do to keep safe. So if that's the sacrifice that the vulnerable populations have made already, then why weren't the other people who could be, as far as we know, safely pursuing their... For example, state of Connecticut, 1,550 daycare centers open. Through this whole thing, they didn't shut down. They kept them open because they considered them necessary for frontline workers to have their kids in. But it wasn't only frontline workers who were in there. The state said this week that less than 10 children and adults died from the disease. Now, how is that possible? I don't understand that at all.
It's possible because there are mysterious elements about this disease that we don't have a clue as to what makes it tick. As opposed to, well, so many of us are safe. The hell with those that are not. You see,
I'm not saying to hell with those who aren't safe. I'm saying those who aren't safe are already keeping themselves safe.
Not all of them.
By socially isolating.
Not all of them. Not everybody. I mean, you can't make a statement like that. I'm not trying to engage you in a superficial debate. What I'm trying to make is the point that we talk about this as if we have an intellectual handle on it, as if we have all the facts, and I don't believe we do.
I'm not saying we have all the facts, but I'm saying that I think given the blind spots that you're pointing out that are inherent in having one of these viruses here, and it's also really interesting what you're saying about that we should not assume that something like this is, and a lot worse is not going to come along someday. And in either scenario, it seems to me what we do is we keep pushing ahead to maintain status quo as best we can figure that we can get away with. So if you're looking, certainly this is how I would do it. If I were a leader moving forward, having this experience behind me, I would say, what we have to do, the most important thing, while trying to keep people safe as best we can, is to keep the status quo as best we can. Because what if it gets worse in 3 months and we've been not doing things we could have done to create food, create keep the supply chain in place. Do you see what I'm saying?
Of course I see what you're saying, and you make a lot of sense. I'm just pointing out the edges to that, where the edges to your point of view, which all borderline on the unknown, and that there's a great unknown factor in this, and it's better to be safe than sorry. And of course the economy must run, and of course we have to get back to work, but we shouldn't get back to work if we can't. We should not assume that, well, we'll just go back to work, and if we die, we die. I mean, it's a lot more
serious.
Can
I tell you one other curious fact about this? I really find these facts fascinating. I was having a debate online with somebody today, so I went to double check, and I searched, I Googled looking for an outbreak of COVID that was linked to the constant shopping that's been going on at busy supermarkets all across the country. Millions of people shopping every day in supermarkets and box stores and all the other essential stores that were kept open. I could not find one story about an outbreak, even coming from grocery store chains or other chains that had outbreaks amongst their workers in their stores. How is that possible? I just find that stunning.
I don't know. I don't have the answer. It could be any number of things. It could be the nature of how the stores are run, the nature of how people deal with being in the stores. It could simply be how long you spend in a building. It could be.
Well, I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah,
I think that last one you hit on is big. Because they say you need a sustained exposure, and they've been telling us not to do a lot of things that don't include a sustained exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And
indoor,
yeah,
outdoor.
Some of that is learning as you go. Yep, all
so,
those factors.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of factors. I'm talking more about attitude. I'm not happy how politicized it's become. I think this is an area where politics should have been just not part of the discussion, and it's the major part of the discussion. And
well,
therefore, when
Are you talking from the point of view of people like us, pundits, or the politicians themselves? Hold that thought.
There's always a correlation for the politics and the pundits. Did you say after break?
Yeah, but I want to find out who you think is making the bigger mistake here. Michael Harrison is here. It's Friday. Stay with us on WTIC. I just wanted to clarify. I was giving numbers off the top of my head. It's 1,552 daycare centers, and the acting public health commissioner said that she thinks the number of children and staff in the daycare centers who contracted the virus, not died of it, but contracted, very, very low, probably less than 10, she said. I just am amazed by that number. So you were going to...
Well, you asked me about pundits and politicians, and I think pundits and politicians are part of the same larger system. I think that we're in the same business, and that is discussing polarity in terms of public policy. So to me, we're all in the same game, and politicians have limited amount of knowledge when it comes to running businesses because most of them are not business people. Most of them are fundraisers, and pundits usually have to root for the team because they are in a daily dance of affirmation with the people that are their fans. So they tell the people what they expect. It's very dangerous to go on the radio or write in a newspaper if you have a reputation for being a conservative or a liberal or a Republican or a Democrat or a libertarian and say something that isn't that because you attract an audience or you target an audience that wants to hear what you have to say. So you become a victim of your own repertoire.
Only if you let them do that to you, because I think people don't know it, but they believe. They actually enjoy a real person rather than somebody they can confine.
Oh, but if we only knew what a real person was, you know,
has ideas that aren't consistent.
Yeah, but it goes back to what we said at the beginning of this program. You know how all of us are different on stage than off stage, even if we mm-hmm. don't realize it, and so much of this is subconscious. You cannot honestly say that you do not. And I'm not attacking you personally. This is part of the game, the syndrome. You cannot say that you go on the radio and don't have somewhere in your mind the awareness that your listeners expect a certain thing out of you? It's a repertoire. It's a, you know, hey, play your hits. I don't want to play my hits anymore. Then we're not going to stay and listen to you sing. You know, it's.
Yeah, but I just think my hit, because that's what I've done here at this station, is to analyze, to dive in and analyze what's going on and filter that through my belief system, which is a libertarian kind of belief system, not a conservative one per se. So I've admitted on the air that I'm that I am an atheist, for example. You know, there's certain things and people just absorb it and say, OK, that's not me.
Yeah.
But I like listening because of whatever reason I like listening.
Yeah, well, I'm not attacking you personally. I think you do a great job of what you do, or I wouldn't
be here.
Feeling
it that way.
Okay, good.
But I think I'm just trying to make the point that I think it's possible that people tend to confine themselves into things they believe they have to do rather than have the audience confine them. But I could be all wet on that. That's just my guess.
Well, we're all wet on a lot of things, and we're right about a lot of things, but we certainly don't know it all. And the fact of the matter is that we're in a society, we're a pack animal, human beings, and we're very influenced by what the people around us think. And we're very influenced by what authorities tell us, and we're still influenced by what comes to us on the tablets of media, whether it's television or newspapers or radio or whatever. We're influenced. And in most cases, if you go to the source of the influence, it's the Wizard of Oz. It's a little man behind a curtain who doesn't know any more than you do.
and we're all traveling in a belief bubble that is in some way communally defined. That's what you're saying, I think.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And there's nobody driving the bus. Who was it, that group? They called it, we're all bozos on this bus. It was like a... Oh God! It was a radio and an album comedy group that was sort of Monty Python esque. I can't remember.
Tell
the
us
name.
About it next week because we've got to run.
Wow! Did this burn up fast? Hey,
yes.
Have a good.
This was fun.
Yeah,
really
have a good
fun
show.
Time.
And
thank
a good
you,
weekend.
Michael Harrison.
Thank you, everybody. Bye bye.
All right, and Michael will be here doing some fill-ins next week, so keep an eye out for him, and keep an eye out for his radio show, syndicated show, carried here on the weekends on WTIC.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.